It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up on Central Time, a look at a unique festival of short plays kicking off the new year in Milwaukee. But first, police shootings and the public demonstrations around them have been a constant in the news this year and this afternoon in the headlines. Just in the last few days, several Midwestern cases in the news. On Saturday, Chicago police responded to a domestic call and fatally shot both a teenager and the downstairs neighbor who opened the door for the authorities. Yesterday, the decision was announced that the Cleveland police officer who shot 12-year-old Tamir Rice will not be charged. And today, Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke will be arraigned for the shooting death of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald in 2014. While deadly police shootings are reported on by the media, they have not been systematically counted or documented in a consistent way. But a group of public health researchers would like to see that change. Joining us now is Nancy Krieger. She's a professor of social epidemiology at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. She's the lead author of a recent paper called Police Killings and Police Deaths Are Public Health Data and Can Be Counted. Nancy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, in the summary of your paper, you say although deaths of police officers are well documented, there's not really reliable U.S. official data on the number of persons killed by the police. Why not?
Largely because these data have not been compiled in a consistent manner. And what has happened is that until now, this has been treated as if it were a matter of criminal justice only and that these are police data. But in fact, these are deaths. And in public health, we count dead bodies. It's what we do. We monitor mortality. And the issue is whether we can get real-time reporting on these deaths, just like we get real-time reporting on other serious conditions in the United States that qualify to be notifiable conditions that are part of our world-class notifiable disease reporting system.
And in this, in your paper, you point out that there are disease conditions that involve far fewer fatalities that are deemed important enough to keep track of. What kind of things do we keep tabs on that would compare with the number of people involved in police-related fatalities?
For example, the disease data that we reported on is actually about living people diagnosed with the disease, so we would know how many people have been diagnosed on a weekly basis, for example, with measles or with mumps or hepatitis A, or Q fever, some very rare conditions, psittacosis, for example. But what is reported on a weekly basis with regard to deaths thus far are the mortality counts for the 122 cities in the United States that have populations over 100,000. And we can know on a weekly basis what is the number across these cities of infants who have died, of people ages 25 to 44 who have died, of people who have died of pneumonia or influenza. So what this is saying is that we can add to these weekly counts the counts of people both who are killed by the police and also law enforcement officials who are killed in the course of duty. And that can be both in the private sector as well as the public sector. These are not only police that are doing the killing, but it's also private security guards.
Earlier this year, we heard from the British newspaper The Guardian, which has a project called The Counted, trying to compile as best they can the data you're looking for, police-involved fatalities. You cite that, actually, in the paper as evidence that this is something that can be done and is a disappointment that it has to be done by a foreign newspaper.
Yes, and I'm not the only one expressing that. The director of the FBI, Comey, has also said that it is ridiculous, embarrassing, and unacceptable that The Guardian, a British newspaper, has better data and more timely data on deaths due to police killings than the U.S. government does. And the point is that The Guardian is a wonderful resource. The Counted website obtains its data through doing searches across the social media. People can report in the events. They look at the news reports. But it's not an official source of information. And part of the issue here is about government and trust. We need to have official data that all sides can trust, that are public health data, that are reportable data, that are consistent data across states, that are collected in the way that public health people always collect data, which is to have a clear case definition, uniform case definition, so that we can compare data across states and over time. And that's what we need to do. It should not be an official mystery in the United States that we do not know the number of people who are killed by police.
Talking to Nancy Krieger, public health researcher at Harvard, calling for a public health collection of data involving police-related shootings and fatalities. That's both people killed by police and police officers killed in the line of duty. So let's get to what seems to be the core of the argument you're making here, that this is relevant public health information that would provide a public health benefit. Why would these police-related fatalities and keeping tabs on them better benefit us from a public health standpoint?
Consider, for example, the civil unrest that ensued in Baltimore after the death of Freddie Gray in police custody in the 6 days between when that occurred and when there were charges brought against the police officers. In that time, there was civil unrest. Communities were really disturbed. There was damage to economic property. There was damage to pharmacies. There were people who were having to come up with alternate arrangements to get their insulin. There were drugs that from the pharmacies that entered the illicit street drug market. That when you get to a point of having civil unrest because of police violence and impunity and the consequences for that violence, you end up having major public health hazards. And there have been public health resolutions. There was one from the American Public Health Association in 1998 calling for better data on what was going on with regard to police violence in the U.S. because that has implications for what people also report. For example, it's well documented in literature on domestic violence that there can be people who are scared to call the police around domestic violence because they're also worried about what will happen when the police come. Larger concern for public health and public well-being. And having reportable, transparent data that is accessible, that people can analyze to see if problems are getting better or worse, to see if there are some areas that have really high rates and some areas have really low rates. That shows you that something is going on. That means that the condition can be prevented. In our study, we also use existing U.S. public health data on mortality rates, and the national data for that are not in real time. States have to clean the data, they have to assemble it, they have to send it off to the CDC to end up with the national mortality data, which are publicly accessible. And we looked at those rates for the past period from 1960 actually to 2011. We can see that within cities over time, the risk ratio, the excess risk for black versus white men, for example, ages 15 to 34, can vary in a given year anywhere from 5 times greater to 19 times greater. And across cities in any given year, you can have cities where the risk is 5 times higher and 19 times higher. That's considering only New York City and Cincinnati. When you've got that kind of variation in the excess risk, you know it's preventable.
And having that kind of data that you're looking for, better data, probably more reliable than that historical data even that you just referenced, would you hope that then we could prevent outbreaks, if I can use that word, of police-related fatalities?
Absolutely. That's the essence of public health, is to acquire data in order to prevent conditions that can be prevented and to improve population health and to promote health equity. We need to have an end to inequitable differences in health. Police killings are one part of that. And by inequitable, I mean avoidable, unfair, and unjust, and unnecessary.
On a practical level, how do you envision collecting this public health data, both about fatalities caused by police officers and, again, of police officers themselves?
This is taking advantage of an already existing reporting system that we have in the United States that is world-class. So this is simply adding to the list of conditions. So any public health or medical person can report the data, whether they are directly there, whether they see a report in the media. It goes directly, you call in and you report in the form just the way that you report for any other condition. The same ways that anybody would now report a case of measles, they could report this. So it's not creating the value of the approach that we're arguing is putting this into a public health lens. This doesn't mean that there aren't also criminal justice issues. This reporting system will say nothing about whether use of force was justifiable or not. That's clearly a matter that's a legal question that belongs in the domain of criminal justice. But what this is saying is let's take a public health lens to the problem. Let's get another sector of government looking at this problem. Let's increase the counting so that we can increase accountability and actually make a change for the better. If we don't know how big the problem is, it's hard to make it smaller.
And this would be something that you mentioned doctors. I imagine coroners also could report to.
Absolutely, but so could public health workers, so could emergency medical service workers, anybody in public health or medicine. We know what reportable diseases are. We know what reportable conditions are. every state has a public list of what those conditions are. It's not a mystery. The whole point is making this not a mystery.
Nancy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Nancy Krieger, professor of social epidemiology at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. She's the lead author of a recent paper, Police Killings and Police Deaths Are Public Health Data and Can Be Counted. The Milwaukee Rep is preparing for their upcoming sixth season of Rep Lab, a one-of-a-kind short play festival featuring several individual plays acted and directed by the Rep's emerging professional residents. Joining us now to talk about this year's festival is J.C. Clements, Artistic Associate and Rep Lab Coordinator at the Milwaukee Rep. J.C., thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the festival, as I understand it, showcases the work of your residency programs there at the Rep. Tell us about the program. This is for actors and directors, too, right?
Correct. We each year invite between 10 and 15 emerging professionals in the theater to join us for a season. And throughout the season, they serve as actors in our productions on our stages. They serve as understudies. We always like to boast that we don't have to cancel performances because we have such high caliber emerging professionals with us who are always understudying those roles. And then at the tail end of the season or mid-season, we always have Rep Lab, our series of short plays. And that's really where the emerging professional residents get to shine and have all the spotlight on them.
I want to get into the plays themselves in a bit, but the mission of this program, is this kind of a artistic mission here that you're trying to bring up the next generation of talent?
That's exactly what we're doing. I'm actually a product of the program. I was an artistic intern 5 years ago. We recently changed the title of the program from artistic internship to emerging professional residency in order to better reflect what the program actually is. And as the director of the residency, I travel around the country to universities and recruit for the program because we are looking for the future leaders in regional theater, people who want to spend their lives acting and directing. And we bring them here to Milwaukee. We provide housing. We provide a stipend. And they spend the season with us under the tutelage of all the master actors and directors that we see around the country.
Well, you've graduated from the program to work with the Milwaukee Rep and the next recruit. Are other people showing up on stages around the country after emerging from the emerging professional program?
Definitely. We always boast that we have about a 90% success rate in continuing their careers from the past 10 years. So if you look at everyone who's come through the program in the past 10 years, 90% are still working in television, film, or theater. And we have people who have worked on Broadway, off Broadway, continue to work here in Milwaukee, in Chicago, and all around the country.
Talking to J.C. Clements with the Milwaukee Rep, talking about the sixth season of Rep Lab, a short play festival coming up featuring, as we've just been hearing, the emerging professional residents there. Well, let's get to the show now. Sixth time around, a lot of times you go to the theater, you see a play, runs for an hour and a half, 2 hours or so. This is a little plays. How many are we talking about in one showing here?
This year we have eight productions, eight specific shows. They all range in length between 10 and 15 minutes. And we always like to say, if you don't like what you're seeing in 10 minutes, you're going to see something else.
Like the Wisconsin weather.
Indeed.
So short plays, it's a different beast than a longer showing. What's different? I know you're directing one of these, I think. What's different as an actor or a director tackling one of these shorter plays?
Well, one of the things is we look at Rep Lab just like we look at a full season at Milwaukee Rep, where the evening is the entire season. So you have a lot of variety in the type of scripts that we produce. So you have a little bit of drama, a little bit of comedy, and then it all culminates in a world premiere play that our emerging professional residents are actually right now in the rehearsal room are developing this play, and it will be premiering at Rep Lab this year.
How do you go about picking scripts? Are there lots of short plays out there to choose from?
You would be surprised by how many scripts there are out there. We did a call about 3 years ago where we called all playwrights and said, send us your short plays. And I think we received around 1,000 or 1,500 of them. Our literary coordinator at the time, she read through a lot of them. I read through a lot of them. And so this year, I think we read about 90 plays, and that's culled down from the 300 or so that we've think are like really core good plays for that age, so the specific ages of our emerging professional residents.
I was looking over the cast list and I see some people turning up in different roles in different plays. And I know it's not uncommon when you do a production for one actor to play a few smaller roles, but it seems like that's going to be different because in these small plays, they're playing a lead role in this one, a lead role in another. Is that a challenge for an actor to play a completely different character and maybe a completely different genre?
I don't know if it's a challenge, but they are really up to it because I would say the depth and complexity that they are bringing to these characters are really great. And it really shows the quality of the actors that we've brought into this program.
Well, I want to check in on a couple of the plays that are going to happen here. A holiday theme, I guess, good for the time of year. Eggnog, Martinis, and Cosmo Ho-Hos. Do I have the name right?
That's correct.
So what's that all about?
Well, that is a short play about two elves, I'll save the suspense. You'll have to come and see to really figure it out. One is a real elf, and one is a play elf who works as an elf, and they meet each other at a bar one night.
All right, and so yeah, that's a good one for this time of year. And then you're directing. This has a larger cast than the rest. Controlling Interest. Tell us about this short play.
This is a really, really fun play. It takes place in high executive office. There's a big meeting happening because there's going to be a big merger. And it turns out that it's a bunch of 8-year-olds who are deciding whether or not they are going to like the girls on the playground.
And your cast, I know these are emerging professionals, maybe young professionals. I'm guessing not 8-year-old professionals.
Correct. It's all done in the style of high executives working in a business office, but all the language that they're saying pertains to being an 8-year-old on the playground.
I'm imagining this is one of the more comedic ones you were talking about earlier.
You are correct.
Tell us about some of the other titles that are going on. Give us a survey of what else will be happening.
Well, we've got, as I said, the devised piece. Right now, they are all working on creating their own story. And that's always, I think, the most exciting thing. Over the past 5 years, we've had 5 world premieres during Rep Lab, and this year we will have a 6th. We have an O. Henry story, While the Auto Waits. Everyone knows The Gift of the Magi during this holiday season. This is another story, and it kind of has a similar tale to it. And then we have a play called Airborne, which explores what it means to be a woman in the Air Force.
Let's talk more about the players and directors here. You mentioned going around the country recruiting. So what kind of geographic range are we going to see represented on stage and behind the scenes at these shows?
Well, we have emerging professional residents who hail from California, Washington, Texas, Georgia, and of course we have 3 that are from Milwaukee.
And Milwaukee is on the map for theater, I think, anyway. But does this kind of program where you're bringing people around the country and then cycling them back out, does it help boost Milwaukee's reputation in the theater world?
Oh, most definitely. You look at a lot of the theater companies that are founded here, many of them are founded by former interns, former residents. A lot of them like to stay, and they continue to work in our theaters. It's really great, and we enjoy working with those actors. And you know, we obviously have a connection as we are fostering their development.
Let's talk about the production a little bit. Since it's a bunch of short plays, I imagine there's not an elaborate set for each one. That would be a whole lot of building and set moving.
That's correct. We really rely on our props artisans at the Rep to create the worlds of these plays because a lot has to come on and come off. Really, in like 20 seconds, we're going from one play to the next. So we have a lot of props that come on and create the world of the play. And 10 minutes later, we have a whole different world. You can go from a bar to an executive's office to the sky.
And I understand, as of last week anyway, 4 out of the 6 scheduled performances were sold out already. A 7th performance is offered. Can you give us info of what's still open and where can we get more info?
If you go to our website, www.milwaukeerep.com, you can find our calendar there that has all of our performances and see where there's availability.
And for people around the state, maybe with their local theater programs, would you encourage them to do something like this, whether it's bringing people around the country or not, but instead of one big production, a bunch of short plays? Do you like that as a format?
I personally love it. I think it's great. You get to see a lot of variety. You see it happening at film festivals where they have a shorts selections. And like I said earlier, if you don't like what you're seeing now, in 10 minutes you're going to see something completely different, and maybe you'll love that.
JC, thanks a lot for telling us about this.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's JC Clements, Artistic Associate and Rep Lab Coordinator at the Milwaukee Rep, talking about the Rep's Rep Lab Festival, which opens next week. It's a series of short plays, 7 performances coming up in January. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's the week between Christmas and New Year's, and millions of Americans are traveling around the country and beyond. Some of those people are going to use the short-term rental site Airbnb. Airbnb allows people to rent out rooms in their houses or entire secondary properties to strangers over the internet for anywhere from one day to weeks. Already has over 1 million rooms available globally, more than many major hotel chains. This past year, the company engaged in heated debates with cities like New York and San Francisco over how these short-term rentals should be regulated. Supporters of the company say Airbnb provides additional income to help residents pay their rent or mortgages. Opponents say it takes properties off the local rental market in many already stretched housing markets. The debate recently arrived in Wisconsin with the Senate and Assembly considering a bill that would block local municipalities from regulating some of these short-term rentals. Here with us now, we have Noah Colwin, Associate Editor at Recode. He's been covering this story in San Francisco and beyond. Noah, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Also with us, Andra Gent, Associate Professor of Real Estate and Urban Land Economics at UW-Madison. Andra, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, Noah, let's start with you. You followed really probably the most heated battle between Airbnb and a local government this year in San Francisco, what they called Proposition F. What were the details? What was behind that debate?
So Proposition F was fundamentally a battle. For starters, San Francisco is perhaps the worst real estate market in the country. It's a very limited housing supply. The prices there are astronomical, and lots of people who've lived there for many decades are getting pushed out simply because they can't afford it anymore. And so the Airbnb debate was over whether or not to more strictly regulate the service in the city. And Airbnb is a close ally of San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee, and the battle that resulted over whether or not to regulate a ballot initiative called Proposition F became one of the most vicious political fights in recent memory in the city. In particular, I think Airbnb spent something more than $8 million, at least $8 million, to win, and they did win by a 10-point margin. And ever since then, Airbnb has been ratcheting up the rhetoric about how it's important and a lifeline for the middle class, for people who share their apartments and so on in San Francisco and beyond to be able to continue to afford their homes as cities across the globe become more expensive to live in.
Are they seeing this as a win and maybe a precedent for elsewhere, or a Pyrrhic victory given that it took $8 million to get that win?
So it's a good question. I think a lot of activists would say it's a Pyrrhic victory, and a lot of the company's opponents say that they plan to do the same thing elsewhere. Airbnb, I think that they've been preparing for this eventuality. The day after they won the vote, they called a bunch of reporters to their headquarters in San Francisco, and they outlined what their political strategy is going to be worldwide. And this included this effort is led by Airbnb's policy chief, a former Clinton administration figure named Chris Lehane, and he outlined a political organizing operation that the company's going to use, basically mobilizing all of the people who rent out their homes on Airbnb in cities across the globe to become advocates for the service, to be people who will be the political activists on the ground, the ones who are petitioning city halls, the ones who are setting up protests, the ones who get out to vote and so on. And whether or not they'll have the same success in San Francisco obviously remains to be seen. Different challenges in different cities elsewhere around the globe. Not every places like San Francisco. But it's very clear that Airbnb recognizes that this is something that they're going to be dealing with going into 2016.
one real estate not much like San Francisco is here in Wisconsin. And Andrew, I want to bring you in on that. We are in a very different housing situation. We don't have huge cities with overstuffed, stressed housing markets. What do you see the debate in Wisconsin looking like when it comes to a service like Airbnb?
You know, so I think the issue, honestly, I think this issue of whether it's driving up apartment rents is kind of a red herring. To me, this is not a big issue even in cities like San Francisco and New York City, where the supply is very constrained. You know, there has been some research done on it, and we're talking, you know, $6 a month in New York City in sort of Manhattan rent. This is the sort of magnitudes we're talking about. So I think this is not the first-order issue. I think the first-order issue I have, which applies to Wisconsin as well as other municipalities, is the taxes. So it does seem like it's a bit of an... So I think the where there really is competition is Airbnb with hotels, mm-hmm. because this is the real substitution that most consumers are considering, right? When I go travel, I'm thinking, do I want to stay at a hotel with all the services and on top of it pay the taxes, right? So often these hotel taxes are very high. They're sometimes 10%, 15%, versus Airbnb, where, you know, it's not a full-service hotel. And so that, to me, is a bigger issue. And I, you know, I'm not concerned about Airbnb at all in Wisconsin if short-term rentals are also subject to these hotel taxes, because I think the hotel taxes can serve a legitimate function.
Are Airbnb rentals, at least in Wisconsin, as far as you know, hypothetically supposed to be paying taxes like a hotel? Do they technically fall under regulation, or are they in a gray area, Andra?
You know, I think that technically they may. So certainly the owners are supposed to pay income taxes on any rental income they're receiving, certainly. As far as I know, I don't believe Airbnb is notifying. I think it's kind of a gray area at this point, and I think it is sort of the onus should be on Airbnb to notify all prospective hosts that here are the hotel taxes in this municipality, in this state, if there's a state hotel tax, and here's how you would go about paying. And from what I can see right now, that's not going on Airbnb. And so that, I think, is somewhere that I don't know. It sounds like your other commentator has more information on Airbnb's strategy, but that to me is where I think Airbnb could be a little more proactive.
It is the holiday travel season. We're talking about debates in Wisconsin, around the country, around the globe over Airbnb. This short-term rental thing allows apartment renters, homeowners, others to rent out their space to travelers for a short period, maybe a little longer period. We have Andra Gent with us from UW-Madison. She studies real estate and urban land economics. Also reporter Noah Cullen, associate editor at Recode. And Noah, let's get to that tax issue. This was part of the debate, I know, in San Francisco. Airbnb saying, hey, we're bringing a benefit to the city. We are generating a lot of taxes. I think the other side saying a lot of the people providing Airbnb maybe not paying the taxes. How big an issue was that in this Proposition F debate?
So part of Airbnb's, part of what Airbnb says, and part of, again, like I guess part of their larger strategy, is that they try and work out agreements with every market that they enter. And, you know, whether it's Jersey City or Sacramento is another recent one, or even Amsterdam. And the idea is that when they work out these agreements with cities, they'll figure out a way, like they'll figure out a process for tax remittance. And so with New York, for example, I think New York is probably the most high-profile fight they're engaged in right now. There are people who, like Airbnb says, we're going to collect taxes on behalf of the city, and we're going to generate all sorts of revenue for the city. I think where regulators have been most concerned and where you see the loudest arguments doesn't necessarily come for taxes. A lot of it ends up coming about whether or not people on the service are operating illegal hotels. And I think... My esteemed co-commentator here made a really good point about how the housing supply in San Francisco and New York City are really constrained, and that's part of where even if like the demonstrated effect that Airbnb has on the supply isn't, you know, it's not necessarily spiking rents a whole lot, there's still a lot of people who feel that there are illegal hotels and services being operated in New York. So here's an example that an apartment that gets rented out for 6 months at a time or more. that's an enormous amount of revenue being generated for Airbnb. And so, yeah, sure, you may collect taxes on it, but the bigger issue is that you're effectively removing those kinds of apartments from the housing stock, and that also you're not regulating them properly, and that those kinds of rentals and those kinds of sublets have to be controlled differently. And that's sort of where you see the biggest amount of, that's where the most tension is right now between Airbnb and regulatory authorities.
And Andrew, I wanted to get into regulation here in Wisconsin. Some municipalities, as I understand, have tried to do new regulations. But one concern that's been raised is if I am running a hotel and I'm registered as a hotel, I have to be inspected. I have to meet certain safety standards, health codes, things like that. Airbnb, maybe not. There's no procedure for investigating Airbnb. How big a concern do you see that as being?
Yeah, so I want to go back to quickly to something Noah was saying about, you know, the idea that there's a whole bunch of the housing stock that is effectively being converted to hotels in contravention of local zoning codes. So I just want to say I think there is some research on Airbnb, and that just doesn't seem to be happening outside of where I do see it happening is actually Honolulu. But I certainly don't see it happening here in Madison. That seems exceptionally unlikely. But going back to the safety concerns, you know, what does it mean to have an illegal hotel? You know, again, if you're concerned about the zoning code, that's where the zoning compliance would come in. As a city comes up with a whole set of land use restrictions, you know, we have a city plan and then a bunch of landlords contravene that. So outside of that, I'm not sure what it means. So in terms of health and safety, of course, you've heard isolated reports of, there was this kid in Europe who ended up having a very awful experience at an Airbnb apartment. But that could happen it could happen in a hotel, and certainly, I don't know about you, but I think most of us have at one point in our life stayed in a legal hotel that was very substandard. I know I have, and I think that you have the same risk with Airbnb. If anything, as you probably know, Airbnb operates on a reviewer system, and so one of the big costs as a host, you never want to get a bad review because that really hurts your ability to get any reservations in the future. And also because a lot of Airbnb hosts are also guests, it will also hurt you in trying to get a reservation yourself as a guest if you've been a bad host in the past. So I guess I'm sort of the belief that you can have bad hotels and you can have bad Airbnb rentals and there's no way of weeding them all out, but I'm not sure that you're more likely to get a bad Airbnb rental than you are to get a bad hotel rental.
Talking to Andra Gent, Associate Professor of Real Estate and Urban Land Economics, UW-Madison, and Noah Colwin, Associate Editor at Recode, talking about Airbnb expanding definitely around the country, letting people rent their places short-term, slightly longer-term to travelers, to members of the community, the Airbnb community, as the company calls it. We want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. What's your opinion about Airbnb and these kind of rentals? Have you used the system as a renter, as a traveler, as both? Do you want to see more regulations, more effort at collecting taxes? Do you think that they're good or bad for your community? Do you want to see more of them in Wisconsin, more of them available wherever you travel? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now with Noah Colwin, Associate Editor at Recode, and Andra Gent, Associate Professor of Real Estate and Urban Land Economics at UW-Madison, looking at Airbnb, the short-term rental website service spreading around the country and encountering some resistance in cities around the world. It's showing up here in Wisconsin, some local regulations and maybe state regulations or counter-regulations coming to override local efforts. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you done Airbnb? Are you a host or a visitor on it? What do you think about it? Do you think cities, states should do more to regulate it or be more hands-off? See it as a pretty good benefit for them. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers now. Lucy is on the line in Madison. Lucy, hi.
Hi. I have used Airbnb, and I love the idea. And, you know, because you can go to a strange place and stay with somebody who's from there, and there are a lot of nice apartments, or, you know, you can you can stay with people, and or you can stay in a place that's all to yourself. But I'm not using it now because they used to have a hotline you could call. Say if you went someplace and you had a booking and you got there and you had no, and there was nobody there and you had no way to get in or something. They used to have a hotline, and they claimed that they would set it up so that you could get a hotel. You know, they would give you a hotel room if necessary. They wouldn't leave you out in the cold. They don't have that anymore, and now you have to email them if you have a problem. And, you know, you go to some strange city and you try to email somebody. I don't even have a good phone for doing that, you know. And so it's kind of frightening to me. And I think it's a wonderful, wonderful idea, and I'd love to see it implemented well, and I think there should be some kind of regulation of it. But I'm real concerned that they're not doing it right when they don't allow for emergencies in a decent way.
Lucy, thanks for that call. Sounds like she had good experiences with it. Noah, worried about a safety net. Do you hear? Is this a common concern for people who use Airbnb?
I've heard it from various folks I've talked to, just that sometimes the services provided to Airbnb guests aren't that great. I think what you hear more about are the edge cases in which something goes, like, really horribly wrong. There was a magazine piece that was widely circulated not all that long ago about somebody whose father died in an Airbnb on a swing, and that there, you know, there aren't the kinds of regulations in place, or that in the case of who do you reach out to, how do you talk to somebody at Airbnb about this. But by and large, those kinds of concerns have been, they've played second fiddle to a lot of what I've covered, and they haven't been as talked about as the larger issues that Airbnb has had, the tussles that it's had with cities.
And Andra, as you pointed out earlier, this might be a nightmare scenario you could encounter with a hotel brand name that we've heard of before.
Yeah, I am surprised that they have discontinued that hotline, because I'm familiar with the hotline that the caller is speaking about. I've used it as a guest, actually. And so it does surprise me they discontinued that, because that does seem like an important service. So whether it's not financially viable for Airbnb to provide that service, or whether they need to raise their fee for that to be financially viable, because that does, as a guest, I would be very concerned about that, to be honest with you. Not so much a safety but what if I can't get into my lodging? Or, you know, that is something that you don't have to worry about with a hotel. So, you know, whether it hugely affects what hosts will be able to charge for their rates, because guests would have less peace of mind. So that does surprise me a little bit.
Lucy, thanks for bringing that up. We'll go next to Alice in West Bend. Alice, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, my son, who lives in California, is the one who turned me on to Airbnb, because since I've retired, I've been traveling quite a bit. And I have had fabulous experiences.
What kind of experiences have you had?
Well, I've stayed in places in as out of the way as Lincoln, Nebraska, Italy, Minnesota, Minneapolis, Oakland, and the Rock Ridge area, which is where I've stayed the most, four times. And I'm actually about to leave a five-week vacation down in Florida, and I'll be staying at a property that is an Airbnb property for 5 weeks.
Alice, thanks a lot for that call. Alice, a retiree, Andrew, in my head when I think something like Airbnb, I'm thinking the youth, the millennials are using this. Is this wider than just a younger demographic?
I think so, most definitely, especially for snowbirds who are going, you know, just like your caller, who are going for an extended stay, who are going for, you know, a month, 2 months, 3 months. It's actually going to be the best way of finding that sort of rental, because odds are if you're not on vacation for a few days, you're there for a month. I think Airbnb fills a niche where it's not a full-service hotel. So I think that, and you know, millennials may love to do that, but they do not have the income or the time to be able to do that. So I think absolutely it is. It appeals to the retirees and sort of baby boomers that are getting, you know, working part-time.
Alice, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking about Airbnb, debates about it around the country. Noah, I wanted to ask, we've mentioned that the hotel industry, understandably not wild about Airbnb, but I wonder about the rest of the travel market in a big city like San Francisco or New York. Do they see it as a benefit, maybe making a city more travel accessible to people who might not be able to afford a full-on hotel?
Well, there's a lot of folks who say that. I think there was a recent Bank of America report that the average stay of the average price for a stay in an Airbnb in New York wasn't actually all that different from a hotel. And maybe Andrew has some better figures on that, or something more to add on that. But I think part of the, like, it's, you could make the, I think the better argument, or the one that's, I think, been particularly interesting for people at Airbnb to tussle with, is that they've had to deal with selling that their service is not just providing, you know, something that is immediately a substitute for a hotel, but that it's a separate experience altogether. There were a bunch of Subway ads in New York, for example, that talked about how Airbnb offered a community, and that it wasn't just that they were offering this huge economic benefit to all the people who rent out on the service, but that you were a part of some sort of home sharing community, that you were that there's some part of the experience that you were purchasing you couldn't otherwise get from a hotel. And so I think when Airbnb talks about its travel experience, and when people talk about the kind of travel experience you get with Airbnb, the company wants to make it very clear that you're not just getting a bed and a room and a place to stay and a shower and so on. You're tapped into some sort of kibbutz-like atmosphere that you wouldn't be able to get through any other way.
And Andra, as we wrap up, do you see this community growing in the future as rapidly as it has up till now?
You know, I'm sorry, I'm an economist, but I have a hard time getting too on board with the community is the main reason people do it. I think that you should be saving a lot of the service costs, because running a traditional hotel is very labor intensive, with a maid service every day, and that sort of labor is very intensive. So if you can cut that cost, which you can with a longer term Airbnb rental, that should reduce costs relative to the amount of space. You're also, of course, getting a living room, your own living room, and usually more square footage, or at least more bedrooms. So I think that's one of the big benefits of Airbnb rentals. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe other people don't think like economists, and they like being part of this community. But my guess is if you interviewed 100 Airbnb guests, they would list economic motives, not a community, as their primary motives.
Thanks to both of our guests, Andra Gent from UW-Madison, Noah Colwin, Associate Editor at Recode, talking about Airbnb. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Harry Enten joins us for our last look at national politics in 2015. We'll find out how a community in Eau Claire is harnessing its own electricity with a solar power cooperative. And we'll hear about a high rating for Everett in Milwaukee to foster achievement among young black men. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9, it's the Joy Cardine Show. Tomorrow morning after 7, Wisconsin is once again among the worst states for drunken driving in a new report. Joy asks this week's big question, what would it take to keep us sober behind the wheel? That's tomorrow morning after 7 here on the Ideas Network. Have you listened to a good book lately? Audiobooks are on the rise around the country and among me, in part because we don't need to lug around CD or cassette players. Our phones or other devices can do the job for us now. A recent Wall Street Journal piece found, hey, some authors are selling more audiobooks than the print versions of their work, sometimes a 4-to-1 margin. I bring this up now because we'll be talking about audiobooks on the show tomorrow afternoon. Right now, though, I'm looking for your recommendations. Do you have a favorite audiobook, a favorite author you like to listen to, or maybe even, and there's a new form of stardom now, a favorite audiobook reader? And also interested in knowing, when do you listen? What kind of activities go well with your audiobook listening sessions? Exercise, maybe, cooking, those are a couple of mine. Driving, that's an obvious one. I know some people who've logged a lot of hours listening to audiobooks. We want to know how you use them and what you listen to over on the Central Time Facebook page. Share yours there. We've got a post just popped up, I think. Or you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. And then tomorrow at 4:30, we're going to get some recommendations from a librarian who's a big audiobook fan herself.